Welcome back, everybody. Today, we're going deep, you know, deep diving into the reign of King David.
Oh, yeah.
One of the most probably the most famous figure in the Bible.
Yeah.
And we're going to be using this fascinating lecture by Dr. Elaine Phillips.
Okay.
She's an expert on the Old Testament.
Right.
To guide our exploration. And
yeah.
Get ready. We're going to uncover how David tackled some serious political and religious challenges as he established his kingdom.
Yeah, David's story is anything but simple. I mean, he is revered as Israel's greatest king.
Right.
But his journey, oh man, it's full of twists and turns and some really tough dilemmas.
Yeah, it's so captivating. And Dr. Phillips really gets into it in the book of T.P. Samuel.
Yeah.
She paints a vivid picture of the kingdom after King Saul's death, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Total chaos. Different factions all vying for power.
Right.
And David was only recognized as king by his own tribe of Judah.
Exactly. He was facing a pretty daunting task. Uniting a deeply fractured kingdom.
So what does he do? First, he makes a strategic move by relocating his capital from Hebron to Jerusalem.
Right.
Now, Hebron was in the heartland of Judah, his home turf.
Yeah.
Why move away from his power base?
Well, that's what makes this decision so brilliant. Choosing Jerusalem, a former Jebusite city, was a stroke of political genius. First, it distanced him from his own tribe, signaling that he wasn't just a king for Judah, but for all of Israel.
I see, playing the neutral card.
Yeah.
But wouldn't choosing a non-Israelite city alienate some of his supporters?
Well, you might think so, but here's where the real strategy comes in.
Okay.
Jerusalem happened to be situated in the territory of the tribe of Benjamin, Saul's tribe.
Oh.
By moving the capital there, David was extending an olive branch to Saul's followers and easing potential tensions.
Wow, I hadn't considered that. He was essentially creating a sense of shared ownership over the new capital.
Precisely. And geographically, Jerusalem was more central,
right,
further cementing David's position as king of unified Israel. But David wasn't just focused on political unity. He also sought to bring the kingdom together religiously.
Okay.
That's where the Ark of the Covenant comes into play.
Ah, yes, the Ark. This is where the story takes a pretty dramatic turn.
Yes.
So the Ark was the most sacred object for the Israelites, symbolizing God's presence among his people.
Right. And it had been kept in various locations. But David decided to bring it to Jerusalem, his new capital.
What's interesting is that Dr. Phillips describes the initial procession as this joyous celebration. They were playing music, dancing, and really going all out. It sounds like one big party. Then things take a rather somber turn.
Indeed. As they were transporting the ark, the oxen pulling the cart stumbled.
Okay.
And a man named Uzzah instinctively reached out to steady it.
Right.
Preventing it from falling.
It sounds like a perfectly reasonable reaction, really.
Yes. But Uzzah was struck dead for touching the ark.
That's a pretty harsh consequence.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder if the oxen stumbling was more than just an accident. Could it have been a divine sign?
It's a fascinating question. Dr. Phillips suggests that Uzzah's death highlights a crucial theme.
Okay.
The importance of reverence and proper conduct when approaching God.
Yeah.
The ark represented God's presence and was considered extremely holy.
Right.
Specific rules dictated how it should be handled.
Mm-hmm.
And Uzzah, even with good intentions, violated those rules.
So it's a reminder that good intentions aren't always enough.
Right.
There's a proper way to approach God with awe and respect for his holiness.
Yes.
It makes me think, was this a one-off event?
Yeah.
Or was this emphasis on proper reverence a recurring theme throughout biblical history?
Well, Dr. Phillips actually connects this incident to the story of Nadab and Abihu.
Okay.
Two priests who were punished earlier for offering unauthorized fire before the Lord.
So it seems there's a consistent message throughout history.
Yeah.
When dealing with God's presence, even seemingly minor missteps can have serious consequences.
Exactly. But there's another intriguing detail that Dr. Phillips points out. When the ark finally arrives in Jerusalem, David is wearing a linen ephod, a garment typically worn by priests.
Okay, this is fascinating.
Yeah.
It raises so many questions. Was David trying to assume a priestly role? Or is there something more nuanced going on here?
That's a great question. Some scholars interpret this as David acting as a priest king.
Okay.
Potentially foreshadowing the role of Jesus, who's described in the New Testament as both king and high priest.
Wait, so this story from thousands of years ago might actually be hinting at a key aspect of Jesus' role.
Yeah.
What's even more interesting is that after the ark is settled, David expresses his desire to build a permanent temple for God.
Yes. but surprisingly, his request is denied.
Denied. I can imagine that must have been quite a blow for David.
Right.
Why would God refuse such a seemingly noble act?
Well, there are a few potential explanations. Dr. Phillips mentions that David had a history of violence.
Okay.
And building a temple might have been perceived as a way to legitimize his power, something God wasn't necessarily endorsing.
So it's not that David was a bad guy, but more about the potential motivations and optics of the temple project at that time.
That's a good way to put it. There's also the fact that temple building in the ancient world was often associated with conquest and dominance.
Oh, okay.
Something that God might have been pushing back against.
It's fascinating to consider the cultural and historical context when interpreting these events.
Yes.
So what happens next? Does the dream of building a temple just die with David's rejected proposal?
Not quite. God chooses Solomon, David's son, to build the temple.
Okay.
Interestingly, Solomon's name, Shlomo, in Hebrew, is closely related to the word for peace.
So God is choosing a man of peace to undertake this monumental task.
Yes.
It seems to suggest that peace is a key element of true worship.
That's a powerful insight.
Yeah.
But before we move on to Solomon,
okay,
we have to address a significant event that casts a shadow over David's reign and has a lasting impact on his family. The story of David, Bathsheba, and Uriah.
It's a story that many are familiar with, but I'm curious to hear Dr. Phillips' take on it. It's a stark reminder that even those considered close to God are capable of making grave mistakes.
Absolutely. And it's important to remember that this story is completely absent from the Book of Chronicles, which was written later.
Oh.
It makes you wonder why the author of Chronicles chose to omit this rather scandalous chapter from David's life.
That's a great point. It speaks to the different perspectives and editorial choices that were made when compiling these biblical texts.
Yeah.
But until it's Samuel, the story is front and center.
And it unfolds with a series of events that have significant consequences. David sees Bathsheba bathing, becomes consumed with desire, and commits adultery with her.
Right.
She becomes pregnant.
Uh-huh.
And David tries to cover up his actions by arranging for her husband Uriah to be killed in battle.
It's a chain of events driven by lust and deceit, ultimately leading to a tragic act of murder. How does Dr. Phillips approach this narrative?
She emphasizes the consequences of David's actions. The prophet Nathan confronts him, reminding him that he has despised the word of the Lord.
And the consequences don't end there. Nathan delivers a chilling prophecy. The sword will never depart from David's house, and calamity will come upon him from within his own family.
Exactly. And this prophecy sets the stage for a series of tragic events that will unfold within David's family.
This is definitely a turning point in David's story.
Yeah.
It seems like the consequences of his actions are starting to catch up with him.
And in part two of our deep dive, we'll explore how Nathan's prophecy plays out and the tumultuous events that follow. Stay tuned. As we delve deeper into David's story, we see the devastating consequences of his actions unfold, particularly within his own family. Nathan's prophecy hangs heavy over the narrative.
Yeah, it's almost as if a dark cloud has settled over David's reign.
Yeah.
We left off with this prophecy that the sword will never depart from David's house. What happens next?
Well, the first tragedy to strike is the death of David and Bathsheba's first child.
That's heartbreaking. It makes you think about the ripple effects of sin, how it impacts not only the individual, but also those around them.
Absolutely. And then, as if that wasn't enough, another devastating event occurs.
Mm.
The rape of Tamar.
This is where the story takes a particularly dark turn. Amnon, David's firstborn son, rapes his half-sister Tamar. It's a horrific act of violence, and it further fractures David's already broken family.
It certainly does. And the way Dr. Phillips presents it, it's clear that this event isn't just a side story.
Right.
It's directly tied to the consequences of David's sin.
Oh, okay.
The scourge of sin, as she calls it, is wreaking havoc on his family.
What's even more tragic is the way everyone reacts. David is consumed with grief and anger, but doesn't take decisive action against Amnon. Absalom, Tamar's full brother, is enraged and plots his revenge.
Yes, and this sets the stage for yet another tragedy. Absalom eventually orchestrates Amnon's murder.
So we have two deaths, a fractured family, and a son who has committed murder now on the run.
Right.
It seems like Nathan's prophecy is unfolding in a very real and terrifying way.
It certainly is. But the story doesn't end there. Absalom, with his charm and charisma, begins to subtly position himself against his father.
This is where things get really interesting. Dr. Phillips describes Absalom as incredibly good-looking and charming. He uses those qualities to his advantage, slowly winning over the people.
Right. He sets himself up at the city gate,
okay,
a central gathering place in ancient Israel,
uh-huh,
and starts holding court.
Okay.
He listens to people's complaints, offers quick judgments, and presents himself as a man of action in contrast to his aging father.
It's a classic power play. He's appealing to the common people, subtly undermining David's authority and painting himself as the solution to their problems.
And it works. Dr. Phillips points out that Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. Eventually, he goes to Hebron, the very place where David started his reign,
right,
and has himself crowned king.
So this is a direct challenge to David's legitimacy and a fulfillment of Nathan's prophecy that calamity would come from within his own family. Wow, it's like everything is coming full circle. The place where David's kingship began is now the staging ground for his son's rebellion. So how does David react to this full-blown rebellion?
He chooses a strategic retreat. Instead of fighting Absalom in Jerusalem, risking a bloody battle within the capital, David decides to flee.
It must have been a painful decision, leaving behind everything he had built.
Yeah.
But even in retreat, David isn't without resources. He still has loyal followers and experienced military commanders.
Exactly. And this is where we encounter a fascinating bit of intrigue involving two key advisors, Ahithophel and Hushai.
Oh, yes. I remember Ahithophel. His advice was considered like the word of God.
Right.
To have him defect to Absalom's side must have been a huge blow to David.
It was. But David had one more card to play.
Okay.
He sent his trusted advisor, Hushai, to infiltrate Absalom's camp.
Oh, wow.
Hushai's mission was to counter any advice given by Ahithophel.
It's like something out of a spy thriller. A double agent operating within the enemy's inner circle. What were the stakes in this high-stakes game of advice and counter-advice?
Well, the stakes were incredibly high. Ahithophel, ever the shrewd strategist, advises Absalom to pursue David immediately while he's vulnerable and on the run.
Okay.
But Hushai, pretending to be on Absalom's side, offers a different strategy.
What?
Wait, gather a larger army, and then crush David decisively.
So it becomes a battle of wits between two brilliant advisors, each trying to sway Absalom in a different direction.
Right.
Who wins?
David's man, Hushai.
Okay.
Absalom, perhaps blinded by his ambition and overconfidence, accepts Hushai's advice, giving David precious time to regroup and gather his forces. This was a crucial turning point in the rebellion.
But even with this victory, I have a feeling this story doesn't have a happy ending.
You're right. The rebellion culminates in a fierce battle between David's forces and Absalom's forces.
Okay.
And in a tragic twist of fate, Absalom is killed, caught in a tree while trying to escape.
It's such a sad ending for a son who allowed his ambition and resentment to lead him down such a destructive path.
It is. And Dr. Phillips highlights David's profound grief at Absalom's death. He cries out, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died for you, Absalom, my son, my son."
It's a gut-wrenching scene. It shows David's deep love for his son, even after everything that has happened.
Yeah.
You can feel the weight of his grief, the pain of a father who has lost his child. But even with the rebellion quelled, the kingdom isn't entirely at peace, is it?
No, it's not. The scars of this conflict run deep. The kingdom is still fractured, and a sense of unease lingers. Dr. Phillips points out that this instability and division continue to cast a shadow over David's reign.
So the rebellion might be over, but the consequences of David's actions, his sin, continue to ripple outward. What happens next?
Well, Dr. Phillips focuses on a specific incident that reveals the lingering tension and unease. David's decision to conduct a census of all the fighting men in Israel.
A census? It doesn't sound all that dramatic. Why would taking a census cause problems?
On the surface, it seems like a simple administrative task. But in the ancient Near East, taking a census was often seen as a prelude to war or forced labor.
Uh-huh.
It was a way to assess your military strength and the resources you could draw upon.
So it was a power move, a display of might that could easily be interpreted as a threat.
Exactly. Even Joab, David's loyal commander, questions the wisdom of this decision.
It seems like everyone around David can sense that something isn't quite right. It's as if they know that this census isn't just about counting heads. There's something more ominous at play.
And Dr. Phillips dives into this mystery by highlighting two different explanations for why David took the census.
Okay.
In Tekun Samuel, it says that the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he incited David to take the census.
Okay.
But in 1 Chronicles, it's attributed to Satan. Satan rose up against Israel and incited David to take a census of Israel.
That's a pretty big difference. On one hand, it's God's anger. On the other, it's Satan's influence.
Right.
It's fascinating how two different accounts of the same event can offer such contrasting explanations.
It is.
What's Dr. Phillips' take on this?
She suggests that these explanations don't necessarily contradict each other.
Yeah.
Perhaps God, in his anger over the ongoing rebellion and unrest in Israel, allowed Satan to influence David's decision.
It makes you think about the complex interplay between divine sovereignty and human free will.
Right.
How can we make sense of those seemingly opposing forces?
That's a question that has been debated for centuries. But what's clear is that David's decision to take the census had dire consequences.
What were those consequences? Did it lead to further unrest or conflict within the kingdom?
It led to a devastating plague that swept through the land, killing 70,000 people.
Oh, wow.
It was a stark reminder of God's judgment and the heavy cost of sin.
Yeah.
Even David, despite being called a man after God's own heart, wasn't immune to the repercussions of his actions.
That's a sobering thought. So we have the census, prompted by either divine anger or satanic influence, followed by a plague that decimates the population.
Right.
What happens next? Does David just resign himself to this fate, or does he try to make things right?
Dr. Phillips focuses on a powerful scene where David encounters the angel of the Lord standing by the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite.
Now hold on, a threshing floor. Can you explain what that is and why this location is significant?
Of course. A threshing floor was essentially a flat, open space used to separate grain from the chaff.
Okay.
It was a place of hard work, but also a place of symbolic importance.
Okay.
The act of threshing represented separating the good from the bad, the valuable from the worthless.
So it's a place laden with symbolism. What happens when David encounters the angel at this threshing floor?
He recognizes that the plague is a direct result of his sin, his decision to conduct the census.
Okay.
And he cries out to God, "I, the shepherd, have sinned and done wrong. These are my sheep. What have they done? Let your hand fall on me and my family." He takes full responsibility for his actions and pleads for his people to be spared.
That's a powerful display of humility and self-sacrifice.
Yeah.
It seems like David, despite his flaws, understands the weight of leadership and the impact his choices have on others.
He does. And in a dramatic gesture, David decides to purchase the threshing floor from Araunah.
Why would he do that? What's the significance of purchasing this specific piece of land?
Well, Araunah, terrified by the plague and the appearance of the angel, offers to give David the threshing floor and the oxen for a sacrifice, free of charge.
Oh.
But David refuses. He insists on paying for it, saying, "I will not sacrifice to the Lord my God burnt offerings that cost me nothing."
That's an interesting detail. It seems to suggest that true worship, true sacrifice, requires a cost.
Right.
It can't be something given out of convenience or without any personal investment.
Precisely. And there's one more layer to this story that connects it to the bigger picture.
Okay.
That threshing floor David purchased eventually became the site of the temple, built by his son Solomon.
No way. So this act of repentance, the sacrifice that David makes, is directly linked to the future establishment of the temple. Mm. It's as if his actions, even in the midst of tragedy and judgment, are shaping the future of Israel's religious life.
It is. And that brings us to the end of this part of our deep dive.
Okay.
We've seen how David's reign is marked by moments of both greatness and terrible failures.
Right.
But through it all, we see God working, shaping history, and ultimately pointing forward to the coming of the Messiah.
Wow, what a journey this has been. We've covered so much ground in this deep dive into King David's life, from his strategic rise to power and his attempts to unify the kingdom to his personal struggles and the tragic events that unfolded within his family. It's a story filled with political intrigue, religious symbolism, and profound human drama.
It really is. And I think what makes David's story so enduring is that it speaks to our own human experience in such a powerful way. He was a man after God's own heart, but he was also deeply flawed. He achieved great things, but he also made terrible mistakes.
Yeah, it's that complexity that I find so compelling. He wasn't a one-dimensional character. He was a real person who wrestled with ambition, temptation, grief, and the weight of leadership.
Exactly. And I think that's why his story continues to resonate with us thousands of years later. It reminds us that even those who are considered heroes or chosen by God aren't perfect. They stumble, they make mistakes, and they face consequences for their actions.
And it's kind of reassuring, isn't it? Knowing that God can work through flawed individuals like us. It makes me think of all the times I've messed up, all the wrong choices I've made, and yet God's grace is still there.
That's a beautiful insight. David's story reminds us that God's love and forgiveness aren't contingent on our perfection. He sees our hearts, our desire to follow him, even when we fall short.
And falling short is something David definitely did. We saw how his actions, particularly in the case of Bathsheba and Uriah, had a ripple effect, causing pain and suffering not only for himself, but also for his family and the entire kingdom. It's a sobering reminder that our choices have consequences that extend far beyond ourselves.
That's so true. Sin can be like a poison, spreading outward and causing damage in ways we might not even anticipate. But David's story also highlights the possibility of redemption and forgiveness. We see his genuine remorse, his willingness to accept responsibility for his actions, and his desperate plea for God's mercy.
It's in those moments of vulnerability and repentance that I think David's humanity shines through the most. He's not just a powerful king or a legendary warrior. He's a man wrestling with his own shortcomings and seeking reconciliation with God. And what's interesting is that even in the midst of judgment and consequences, there's a sense of hope that runs through David's story. We see it in those moments of foreshadowing, those events that point forward to something greater.
You're picking up on a key element of Dr. Phillips' lecture. She highlights how certain events in David's life, like his move to Jerusalem, his desire to build a temple, even that scene at the threshing floor, all seem to prefigure future events, particularly those related to the coming of the Messiah.
It's almost as if we're catching glimpses, these subtle hints, of what God is going to do in the future through Jesus. And what's fascinating is that David, despite his flaws, becomes almost a prototype, a figure who prefigures the true king and priest who will ultimately redeem his people.
That's a really insightful way to put it. And that's the beauty of diving deep into these stories. We uncover layers of meaning, connections we might not have seen before, and these echoes of something larger than ourselves.
It makes you realize that even though David lived thousands of years ago, his story is still incredibly relevant today. It teaches us about God's grace, the consequences of sin, the power of repentance, and ultimately the hope we have in Jesus. It's a reminder that we're all part of this larger narrative, this ongoing story of God working in the world and in our own lives.
That's a beautiful thought to end on. I think that's what I find so captivating about David's story. It invites us to consider our own place in this grand narrative, our own struggles and triumphs, and how God might be using us, flaws and all, to accomplish his purposes.
Well, thank you for taking this deep dive with us into the life of King David. I hope you found it as thought-provoking and insightful as I have. And remember, as you continue to explore David's story and legacy, what aspects of his journey resonate with you the most? What lessons can you apply to your own life? Until next time, keep seeking, keep questioning, and keep diving deep.